The IntraFish podcast is brought to you by DSM Animal Nutrition and Health, accelerating sustainable and profitable aquaculture.
Hello and welcome to the IntraFish podcast, where we bring you the most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Editor-in-Chief Drew Cherry, joined by Executive Editor John Fiorillo. We're going to dive down into a couple of stories from the past week. It has been, of course, another interesting, very busy week, as it always is in seafood news. We're going to look at a couple kind of different ones that we haven't really dived down into in a while. A while back, I think you remember, we talked about the Maine lobster fishery. We talked about Seafood Watch, the challenges that fishery has faced because of marine mammal regulations, because of allegations of potential impacts on whales. And there's so much debate over when any entanglements happened, when the last time was, what kind of gear whales are being entangled in, or if it's shipping vessels or what it might be. It is an absolute hot box, and there are so many opinions on it. But long and short of what has happened for the fishery is its Marine Stewardship Council eco-label was suspended. Marine Stewardship Council, let me just pause for those that don't know what it is. It's the largest eco-certification in the world. And the MSC eco-label is kind of a ticket to entry for a lot of retail and food service companies, particularly in Europe, but also in the U.S. It's at least, in one way or another, every major retailer, every major food service company that you can think of has made some measure of commitment to the Marine Stewardship Council over the past couple of decades. Maine lobster has had the certification, and it was holding that. It did have it suspended for a brief period, got it back. And then there was a court case, a ruling in July, that said that what the Maine lobster fishery is doing to avoid and reduce the risks of endangering right whales didn't meet the requirements of the U.S. Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act. So the suspension that came in the wake of that led to the lobster sector looking for an expedited audit to get that certificate back. And news broke last week that they have dropped that effort. There are opinions on why they did that. There are strong opinions as to why that was a good idea. The group that was the client for that certification, the Maine Certified Sustainable Lobster Association, some members there say they're still going to pursue it, but they want to step back, get their ducks in a row, kind of produce the information that's needed, because you know there's so much evidence that the sector says they have, that there have not been any interactions with whales, or very, very few, over the past decade or more. And so the allegations of the industry is that the MSC data that was used was actually outdated. Or the data that was presented on the whale entanglements was outdated. So anyway, going to be more efforts on that to possibly get that certification back. But there's also some people that have said, you know, it is maybe not a certification that the fishery needs. This is not the first time that fisheries have said that the MSC certificate is not important to their the sales of their products. That hasn't typically been an opinion that people have held for a long time, because they have tended to hit a wall of reality from their client saying, no, that's not the way it works. You have to have an MSC certificate. But lobster may be different. So let's talk about it, John, with that kind of long intro, which shows just how complicated it is. What was your view on what the decision for the lobster sector to step away from that process?
Yeah, I mean, it surprised me a little bit, given, you know, all the years of being involved in it. Also given that the Canadian lobster fishery still is carrying the MSC seal. So, but after the story we did, I mean, you can only walk away with one conclusion from that story, and you said it a few seconds ago, is they don't really think it matters in the market. You know, they think it's not a big deal for their customers. So, you know, let's keep in mind that an MSC certification is an expensive undertaking all the way through, from the certification itself to the companies maintaining their chain of custody certifications. It costs money, it costs time, and it's somewhat complicated from a paperwork point of view. So if you're faced with, well, our customers don't really give a hoot about it, and now you have this opportunity to walk away from it, I think that's the you know, the calculus being done in the heads of many of these main lobster people, and they're saying, let's put it on the shelf for a little while and think about this. Now, the interesting part is the Canadian fishery, just last week, I think it was, or the week before, there was a bona fide entanglement of a right whale linked to that fishery. We haven't heard yet really what the MSC is going to do in this case. We suspect that there will be something to address this when the fishery is up for an annual audit, which I don't know when that is exactly, but they could also, the MSC could also call, you know, like an immediate audit to really address what may be the problem here. So we'll have to see where that goes. But I will say, I want to broaden this out just a tiny bit, because this is something you and I have talked about for many years. And the MSC started basically in 1997, the whole sustainability movement built up over the past decades and has solidified itself in the seafood business. And that's indisputable. That's fact. And, you know, some people hate it, some people like it, some fisheries will never get it, some are working to get it. So it's just embedded is what I'm trying to say. However, the world is changing in the sense of climate change, and I think the MSC may have trouble keeping up with these changes as it pertains to fisheries. And what I mean by that is, as fisheries move out of their normal ranges, as fish move out of their normal ranges, and the fishery is fundamentally affected because of that, whether it's in a different location now, or the biomass is being reduced, the MSC certifications are going to be in conflict with this, and I'm not really seeing how that's going to work out. The right whale is kind of an example that there's a lot of belief that the whales are migrating differently now than they were, you know, years ago, and that different migration is taking them into fishery areas where they hadn't been, thus interacting with, you know, in this case, lobster, perhaps. So I'm really interested in understanding how that will happen, how climate change will impact what has been the stability and sustainability certification. It's just been kind of stable for years, but it feels to me like something fundamental is going to shift here over the next decade.
It's interesting. I mean, I think climate change is one for sure. In terms of the potential impact on generally on sustainability, because there are sustainable fisheries that there's no way for us to know if they're going to continue to be sustainable or if they're going to be in somebody else's waters. And we see that with the Northeast Atlantic and the problems they're having managing pelagic fisheries. I mean, you think it's bad now, just wait till these fish start moving all over the place. I don't think we're going to have the cod wars again when Iceland and the UK were taking up arms to fight over cod. But I do think that you can see, like you said, John, issues like this continuing to crop up. We've seen the Bering Sea and the collapse of the red king crab fishery there, and the snow crab fishery. It's expected to recover, but again, there's these fluctuations that are happening, and they're extreme fluctuations. So, the Marine Stewardship Council is theoretically designed to be able to, to ride those fluctuations, and the key is that the management remains robust. Stocks are going to fluctuate, that's a fact. But there's it's much more than just kind of the biomass being down one year and up the next year. These are big things, like you said. Now, the other thing I think that's interesting about eco-labeling and sustainability is, like you said, John, it's kind of even hard to imagine that the industry was so anti, I want to say anti-sustainability in terms of the concept. I think the industry, when you rely on a fish, and given sort of management practices that were already in place, there was obviously support for those fisheries, for these fisheries to remain healthy for years and years and years. That's obviously number one. But the idea that there was to be a third party arbiter of that, that you couldn't just kind of rely on your government agencies to manage them, that you needed somebody to tell you, yes, third party, this is a sustainable fishery, here's the stamp. I mean, the opposition to that was insane 20 years ago. And it's amazing to see how that's changed. But I do think now that it's become the ticket to entry, now we have these other issues cropping up that are taking on more importance. Emissions alone is sucking all the air out of the room in terms of what sustainability is all about now. And in concert with that are human rights. In fact, there was a big report that just came out from a human rights group about how all these different eco labels, including the MSC, are not living, or they don't, it's not that they don't live up, it's that they don't have any key indicators for how to take to for how to ensure that these fisheries are meeting human rights standards. So it's a report from the Human Rights at Sea, if you want to find that and read it. It's called Does It Do What It Says on the Tin? But anyway, I think those are kind of interesting things that may indicate that, all to say that an eco label may not be enough. I don't think any fishery can probably get away without having some kind of eco label, and the Marine Stewardship Council is so big and so influential, I'd be hard pressed to see that anybody could step away from it. But I could be wrong,
Well,
John. We don't have great examples of people doing that and being successful.
Well, but I mean, a fundamental, well, why won't they step away, right? I mean, because as far as a marketing and market access stamp of approval, if you will, it has become vital, I guess, in most cases, I would say. But I will ask you, do you think the fisheries are better managed because of the MSC's efforts over the last 20, 30 years, whatever it's been? Do you think things are, if they hadn't come along and none of this happened, do you think we'd have fisheries in ruins? Do you think it'd be just as it is today? That's the part I wonder about sometimes. I understand, like, the label, its evolution and how it's become, a must-have, really, just to be in the marketplace. I still don't think consumers know what the hell it is, but that's a whole nother discussion. But at the wholesale level, it's like you said, it's a ticket to get in into the show. So, but my question is, has it made any difference in the water?
I'd argue that it has, in terms of not in. I think there's some fisheries that would have remained robust because the management systems were already in place. But I do think it's led to a lot more engagement among retailers, in particular, among other stakeholders along the value chain, and just having people think about these different issues in a more directed way, meaning that companies don't just kind of meet the rules and then beyond that not have to care too much about their practices. So I just off the top of my head, there are fisheries I think that wouldn't change, that have not changed that much because of the MSC. First one that comes to mind is Alaska salmon. Nothing's different. It's the exact same way it's been managed for 100 years. And so I think it would be naive to say that the MSC has changed a lot of these fisheries management practices to make them more sustainable. I think it's better to, again, see it as a basically a audit that these fisheries are being well managed. And I think that's sort of the confusion, right? Is there is this confusion that, oh, if you get the MSC stamp, you're making changes. That's very rare. There are objections processes, and there are guide there's different areas that you get scored on that you can make those scores go up or down with a few changes, but they don't seem to have that much teeth in terms of they don't seem to those little things don't seem to actually dictate whether or not you have a certification. That's why I think the suspension of the lobster fishery was so different. And I guess it's because of a legal ruling, and maybe that's how why this was different. But there's changes all the time that I do wonder if the MSC is going to be able to react to those quick enough, as you said. For example, about climate change. So, to answer your question, I think in some cases, yes. Especially some of the smaller scale fisheries, I think there's been some help to get management systems in place for those fisheries. But some of the larger Western, larger fisheries in the north were really already sustainable in terms of their management practices, or as sustainable as the management of those fisheries was managing them to a sustainable level, I should say. Whether or not the fisheries are sustainable, that has nothing to do with the MSC. That has nothing to do with a lot of things. That has to do with the food in the water and what happens in the ocean. So, I don't know. Did I dodge your question well enough?
No. I think that's a good way to put it. I really do. I love the first part of what you said. It's just kind of brought the whole supply chain together to understand first sustainability and then work towards it. I mean, the example I use all the time is at the retail level, on the highest corporate level of retailers, Kroger's, all those guys, it is part of their policies, and it's not just for seafood, but seafood was one of the first ones that if you're sourcing seafood, you have to source it through a third-party certification. In most cases, it was MSC if it was wild. So I totally agree with that. I do not think that Maine, if indeed they entirely walk away from the label, I don't think that will spread to other fisheries. I just don't think that's, we're going to see something like that because, in the story you referenced that Rachel wrote this week, lobster's different. It's just different. It's first of all, a lot of it gets sold at food service, and there's no certification labels going on there that it face the customer. So, that's a little different. And at retail, if it's Valentine's Day and you want lobster, it's an impulse thing a lot of times. Oh, we're gonna have lobster tonight, yay! And there you go. I don't think you're gonna go there and go, oh my, oh shit, I was gonna buy this, but it's not MSC. Oh honey, we're gonna have to settle for some cod, maybe some pollock.
No, I think the jury's still very much out on whether or not the MSC eco label is going to change purchasing decisions in that way. I think they can say pretty clearly that there's been on the retail side of things that they've gotten retail buyers to change, but I'm not sure to what extent any of the that you can say that the MSC actually changes purchasing when people get in the store, generally in the stores. I think if you're going to Marks and Spencer or Waitrose or Whole Foods, yeah, maybe, because you're already stepping in there with an expectation of something, a more, at least a more expensive product. But you're thinking maybe that you're getting something more sustainable there as well. And not only that, just in thinking about Maine lobster and its sales demographic, I mean, for example, it's, I mean, one person quoted in Rachel's story said, it's when all the tourists come up in Maine, they all want lobster. I mean, that's not going to, eat up all the lobster that's caught annually, but like you said, it sort of sits outside of the industry in an interesting kind of way. Now, the other thing to think about is China, which has been a massive market for lobster, in particular Canadian lobster. Many of those processing companies up in Atlantic Canada, a lot of them have Chinese owners. Just to get that flood of product over into China, it's such a popular species with Chinese consumers, especially upper middle class, middle and upper middle class consumers. And I think that you will see and have seen, I'm just looking at the NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Fisheries Department. They have a trade database, and I'm just pulling it up here. And the exports of lobster from the US to China have exploded since around, well, they were almost next to nothing in 2010. About 300 kilograms, and they're up to 6,000, or I'm sorry, 300 metric tons, and now it's up to 6,136 metric tons, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's lobster. That's a lot. So let me put it in terms of money. In 2010, about $7 million, $7.3 million worth of lobster was shipped from the U.S. to China, and in 2022, 145.6 million. So it's becoming a big market. Now, you saw a blip, right, during COVID, and also because of trade battles with China as well. So you saw a big hit in 2019. But anyway, it just I think there is probably an argument to be made there that that in some ways having an MSC certificate for Maine lobster may not be the absolute crucial thing that it can be for other fisheries.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay, now let's shift to another story that definitely you don't see on our pages that often. It is a story about Norway's largest cold water prawn harvester, Stella Polaris. They catch cold water prawns in the North Atlantic on large trawl vessels, and they applied for some funds, some research funds from the Norwegian government, to look at a feasibility study of putting nuclear reactors on trawlers, to power trawlers. And wow, the response to this was pretty funny because it seems so outlandish that putting a nuclear reactor on a fishing vessel, when you put it like that, when you say putting a nuke on a boat, it just sounds like the worst idea in the world. But this is why this is a topic I chose, that I argued with John, that I wanted to talk about today, because I really feel like this is not a bad idea. And why is it not a bad idea? I think that, well, let's just say this. The development director at Stella Polaris, I think he said it best. His name's Jaran Rao, and or maybe it's Haran Rao. I'm sorry, I apologize if I'm pronouncing that wrong. But anyway, he said that we're simply taking the initiative to discuss nuclear power. Radical challenges such as climate and sustainability require radical solutions. I really admired that they were looking into this idea. Now, listen to some of these statistics here. So, a large shrimp harvesting vessel typically takes on 350,000 liters of marine fuel every 5 weeks, towing 2 to 3 fine mesh trawls. Think about that amount of fuel and the cost that goes into that. Now, by the way, callback. The cold water prawn fishery is Marine Stewardship Council certified. It's got a great track record of being not only sustainably managed, but Norwegian trawlers, they have invested a lot of money to ensure that the crew are enjoying their work there, insofar as they can in some of those high seas. So you're talking about a fishery that's really kind of exemplary. So why not change the fuel when it changed this one little thing? Over to you, John. Nukes on boats. What do you think?
Oh, well, like most Americans, nukes scare me. So my knee-jerk reaction would be like, oh no. But I think when you again broaden this discussion out a little bit, you have to, like you say, you kind of have to applaud them for thinking in this direction, because we know fossil fuels are running out and we don't have many, if any, large commercial fishing vessels that are electric. I'm not saying that won't come, but when you're dealing with a product that you have to go out to sea for months at a time and sail around and find it and then sail on back. I mean, you highlighted, just the fuel alone is really expensive. So, it's just part of this ongoing evolution of the world right now, in the context of climate change. And does anybody think all these vessels, these factory trawlers and these larger vessels, even the smaller vessels that operate in Bristol Bay or the inshore cod fishery in Norway or wherever it may be. Do we really think those will be running on diesel fuel or whatever fuel they use, a decade or more from now? I mean, it seems unlikely to me. I mean, look at the uptick, the pickup in electric cars. I mean, at some point, we're going to reach the tipping point where gas stations are going to be completely converted to electric car recharging stations or some whatever you call those things. And so that change is coming. Now, is a mini nuclear reactor my first choice? Probably not. But hang on, folks. This is, sign of the times.
I think, and part of why I wanted to raise this is just to get that discussion going about fuel and about sustainability, because fishing has a disadvantage now to aquaculture. I know there's been a lot of life cycle analyses, and I've seen a lot of reports that have put fishing at having less carbon emissions than aquaculture. There's a lot of different reports and a lot of different ways that you can look at some of these reports that can sort of favor whichever one you want to favor. But I still think that the fishing industry, their big issue is going to be emissions. And because that is, you burn so much fuel. You're out there catching a sustainable product, assuming that these fisheries are sustainable and well managed. So there's and there's still interest, demand, desire to have wild fish and wild seafood, and there is an efficiency to how it can be harvested in fishing vessels and large trawlers. I know. There's a million different things about trawling that people can attack me on, and you know where to find me if you guys want to fill my inbox up, which people do all the time, especially with our podcast, John. But anyway, so if the fishing industry wants to keep up with all these changes that are happening in aquaculture to become more sustainable, and those changes are happening so quick. I think fuel and how these vessels are powered needs to be really high on the agenda. Now, whether that's electric, like you said, John, there is sail technology, which is kind of interesting. There is all kinds of different ways of looking at fuels. Nuclear power is one of those unfortunate things that there has been, it's so associated with terrible, horrible tragedies, and that should keep people skeptical to a certain extent. But at the same time, the technologies change, and the emissions out of nuclear power are pretty amazing. What they can do. This could be a zero emissions harvesting activity. Similarly, there's other fuels that have the same kind of amazing potential. Hydrogen, but again, one very tragic but very high profile accident 100 years ago, the Hindenburg. That is part and parcel of why people are reluctant to embrace hydrogen fuel. And here we are 100 years, 100 years later, things have gotten a little bit different, people and technology. That's humans for you. But I think that this is technology that could be absolutely game changing. But it's one of those things where getting people to change their minds about these things is really, really difficult. So I really applaud Stella Polaris for bringing it up, because nobody else, or very few people, are going to be kind of bold enough to say, you know what? Why don't we at least look at a feasibility study? Because why not? Otherwise, nobody's going to look at at finding these different fuels. So, yeah, I think
Yeah.
it's interesting.
Well, and when you think about fishing's ability to mitigate climate change related things versus aquaculture, especially land-based, if we want to throw that in there. I mean, if you're running an aquaculture operation, a lot of times you can have solar power, you can have some sort of wind power, you can have alternatives to, standard fuel. It's a little harder, at least at this point right now, to do that in a commercial fishing venture. So that, in essence, that will obviously give aquaculture one more advantage as time goes on. So it's really interesting. I mean, you just feel like so much has already changed, but is going to change here in the very short term. So I don't know about nuclear power on a boat, but I do, as you did, applaud these guys for taking a look and trying to think outside the box, as they say, and push the discussion forward somehow.
What do you think about these new horseless carriages, John? You know
Well,
that
they'll
Henry
never catch
Ford is
on.
putting off the line there.
They'll never catch on. They're dangerous, and they're like a bomb. They have fuel in them. They'll explode.
Yeah.
Don't buy one.
Yeah. Now, I can see from a PR perspective, oh, good luck. Of course. Man. Oof. That's going to be the absolute hardest hurdle. But from a power and a emissions perspective and an efficiency perspective, as you said, John, these kinds of ideas have to be put on the table. And the seafood industry is notorious for coming late to these parties, and because it's a traditional industry, you do things the way you've always done it, and then that's kind of how the industry has gotten itself in a bind on sustainability, for example, both in aquaculture and fisheries. So,
But with the nuclear situation, you only get one mistake, right? I mean, the Exxon Valdez, I know it wasn't a fishing boat, but it spilled oil all over the place. That didn't stop, oil tankers from operating the next day or anything like that, and it hasn't stopped them, obviously. But if your fishing boat melts down in a nuclear disaster, I'm pretty sure that's the last boat on the planet that's ever going to be equipped with nuclear power. So, the margin for error is, let's just say, slim.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Don't pretend you know how a nuclear reactor leaks or whatever. I don't
I
either.
don't know anything about a nuclear reactor. I'm not trying to make pretend I do, but I do know when they go bad, they go horribly bad.
You just tell the crew to be careful. It's just like with the Hindenburg, you put those booties, put felt on the bottom of your shoes, and don't cause any sparks, and everything will be just fine. As much fun as it is to give them a hard time, again, I wanted to talk about this because I hope it generates some discussion out there about different ways to power vessels in the fishing industry. Because, again, I mean, you've talked about this, John, in the past. I mean, and maybe this is a little bit of romanticism here, but having wild fisheries is, I think, an important part of our culture as human beings. I don't think we should be harvesting everything. I think we should be harvesting only sustainable fisheries. And I do take some issue with every single species in the world showing up on all over the place. We need to be selective. But at the same time, it is an important part of who we are. And I think moving towards sort of a monoculture or I would say maybe a triculture of aquaculture species. I don't know. That might be a difficult thing for humanity to completely step away from a wild seafood. But again, I mean, this is my own romance, I guess, about the sector. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, let's not forget how many jobs around the world are tied to fishing. I mean, It may be romantic in some ways, the lure of the sea, and you fished, your family fished. I have one of my sons has fished. I've fished. I know what it's like. It's kind of cool. And you're right. I mean, I think it would be a loss if that all went away. And I don't feel that it is going to go away, but it's going to change just like anything else. And this particular example we're talking about with powering vessels is probably one area that will get a lot of attention in the coming years. So, So enjoy your nuclear powered boat, Drew.
Well, maybe my next car. Maybe that's what I should do. We'll see. But yes, well, it's going to be fun to hear what people have to say about it. I hope people hope it generates some discussion as our podcasts usually do. Last week, man, all right, I get it. I get it. People like their fresh fish counters. People were very very unhappy with my idea, not my
You
idea, but
overstepped.
my embracing the idea of the fish counter maybe going away or at least kind of not being everywhere. John argued
You
against it.
overstepped. You went too
Apparently.
far, brother. Yeah, I'm telling you, man. People want fish counters, but a lot of people agreed with you, and a lot of them pointed to, poor quality and poor service at these places. And that's one thing we pointed out several times in the podcast. It's like you gotta have knowledgeable people behind the counter, one, and two, good product has to come in the back door first because it's not going to be made magically better in the fish case sitting out there for a day or two. So, couple things to keep in mind, folks.
Yep, I stand by my assertions, but
Yeah,
yes, I did
whatever.
not realize just how passionate people were about it. I should have, I guess. But anyway, keep the emails coming. We love it because that's part of what we really enjoy with our podcast is we get to talk and give opinions and hopefully get people out there talking, whether it's on social media or on our pages. So remember, you can contact us editorial at intrafish.com is our general editorial inbox if you have tips, story ideas, complaints. If you have complaints, it's john.fiorillo@intrafish.com. Any hate mail, John will get it to me. Just send it to him. Now we have Boston. Well, first we have Bergen, the North Atlantic Seafood Forum coming up. And that is next month, and we'll be there covering that. That's always a great show. It's got so many top executives there, so I'm looking forward to that. Always learn a lot there. And then the month, or sorry, just a few days after that is the Boston Seafood Show, and everybody's excited for that right now. I think it really does feel like we're kind of getting back, much more back from the pandemic than we have been before. And we have an event on March 17th that will be held there on or actually will be held that morning on the 17th. And that we've got great lineup of speakers: Silver Bay Seafoods, Clearwater, Seafood Exchange, Red Lobster. That's going to be a lot of fun. So we'll be moderating a debate there, and it's always a great crowd. So hopefully you can see us there. It's intrafishevents.com. And then remember, last little plug to go to intrafish.com. Of course, if you're not a subscriber, you should be. There's plenty of information on what you get with your Intrafish subscription. If you are a subscriber, as I mentioned last week, John Fiorillo has a new newsletter coming out, The Wave, and it's going to be covering downstream markets, retail, food service, consumer trends. I've seen early drafts, and I'm really excited about it, so I'll look forward to editing it and getting it in my inbox. So that's easy to sign up to if you're a subscriber. So don't miss that. That should be hitting your desk. So, thanks everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.
The IntraFish podcast is brought to you by DSM Animal Nutrition and Health, accelerating sustainable and profitable aquaculture.